Please welcome Chris Grundler.
You've seen your name on the walls. When one little bomb leads to shock, yes, a beat.
I was listening to Bob and sending a text to my office asking for an internal investigation on who the hell agreed that I would appear right after his remarks. I mean, come on. The number one rule of speech making is never follow an astronaut and never follow Bob Dineen's State of the Industry address. So, Bob, I appreciate the warm remarks about my agency and our work. I know they were sincere. And now I know why I was invited back. I frankly wasn't expecting to be invited back, given the events of the last 15 months, and I wouldn't have blamed you. But I'm glad you did invite me back, because I wanted to come to Texas and personally tell you all how sorry I am that we did not get our work done. We did not finalize a standard in 2014 that I promised we would when I appeared before all of you in Orlando. I know words are cheap, but in this case, they are sincere. Because I know and I get that there are consequences when government fails to act and fails to make these decisions. There are consequences for producers, and there are consequences for obligated parties alike. And as someone who has devoted his entire career to public service, this simply is not acceptable. So with the exception of probably everybody in this room, there is no one more frustrated than I am and that my team is about the current state of affairs. I'm getting out of the promising schedules business, we are determined to get the RFS back on track this year, and I'll have more to say about that in the moment. But first, I want to talk a little bit about why we do our work at EPA and what motivates us, what drives us. The fact is, how we move goods and people around this planet has significant implications for our energy consumption, our energy security, our air quality, and the future of the planet in terms of what kind of climate are we going to be living with. My office is dedicated and completely committed to working toward a more sustainable transportation future. And we know to do so, we need to do three things. The strategy for sustainable transportation is pretty straightforward. We need to dramatically improve the efficiency of our cars and trucks. We have to improve the efficiency of the entire system of how we move goods and people around. And yes, we have to lower the carbon intensity of our transportation fuels. And if we take meaningful steps in each of these areas, and we have to take steps in each of these areas, we've done the math. You can't simply do one of these things or even two of things. You have to turn all three of these knobs from a policy perspective to achieve what science is telling us we need to achieve in terms of reducing emissions. But if we take these meaningful steps in each of these areas, I'm convinced, and my colleagues are convinced, and this administration is convinced, that we will create opportunities, economic opportunities, as well as other opportunities in terms of public benefits and environmental benefits. This is my impression of Mark Rubio. Sorry, Jeff Cooper. We have taken some very important first steps in this regard, indeed, historic steps. My office, working with others, have completed now three separate sets of greenhouse gas emission standards, the first ever greenhouse gas emission standards, two for passenger vehicles, one for heavy trucks, and we're working on a fourth for commercial trucks and buses to lower greenhouse gases from these vehicles. These are already on the books. No one has filed a lawsuit against us. These reductions are happening. They are banked, and they will improve the efficiency of the passenger car fleet. We're going to double the fuel efficiency of the passenger car fleet and reduce those emissions by half by 2025. No one thought it could be done. We did it working with the industry, and now they are on the path, in fact, ahead of the path, to get those reductions for all of us. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary of something called the Smart Way Transportation Partnership Program. We have over 3,000 partners in the shipping and trucking fleet business to improve the efficiency of how we move goods throughout the entire supply chain. This has reduced millions of tons of CO2. And yes, as you well know, as Bob has laid out, we have in this country produced and consumed more renewable fuels than any other country combined. And that's a significant achievement. With respect to clean air, we have made huge strides in reducing the harmful emissions from the transportation sector, and most recently completed what we call the Tier 3 next generation clean car standards and clean fuel standards that lower sulfur from gasoline. This year, starting January 1st, ships operating off our coastline up to 200 nautical miles have to use fuel, bunker fuel, that is 90% cleaner than what they have been previously using. This action alone has produced more public health benefits than practically anything we have done in our history. And my team went to London and achieved that result at the International Maritime Organization. So in all of these endeavors, what we strive to do at EPA is take what we call a performance-based approach. We don't like to mandate particular technologies. We don't like to mandate particular fuels. We think our government is best at establishing a performance standard and then letting the market compete for the best outcome. And through that competition, costs are lowered and the best results are achieved. So enough beating around the bush. Let me talk about today's reality. You all know what the RFS law says. You're well aware of what we proposed last year. I came to Orlando to explain our reasoning behind it and to try to convince you that it indeed was a proposal and urge you to comment on it, and indeed you did. Thank you very much. And you're also painfully aware of the current situation. I think Bob accurately described it. Obviously, implementing the RFS has proven to be very challenging for us. If I had been in that room 7 or 8 years ago with Bob and Red Cavaney, I probably would have pointed out that doing annual rules, proposing and finalizing rules with public comment in 12 months is a tall order. And it becomes an even taller order when the policy has become as fraught as it is today with so many different points of view. But I'm not going to stand here and make excuses or to blame others, although I've been taught that the first rule of management is to assess blame. I'm not going to do that today. We didn't get it done, and that's a fact. But I promise you it was not from lack of effort on the behalf of my team and everyone working on this. But to me, this is way more than simply a matter of schedule and being better administrators and being better project managers and getting our work done on time and getting decisions made. There's so much more at stake. Bob laid it out. I've summarized it as well. To me, it's simply mission critical that the RFS get back on track and we have a long-term trajectory in this country for lowering the carbon content of transportation fuels. We're not going to get what science is telling us we need to achieve in terms of public health and averting the worst impacts of climate change until we get on a long-term path for lowering the carbon content of transportation fuels. So how are we going to do that this time when we failed last time? Well, the main part of our plan is to do what we're calling a three-year rule. You know, we intend to put out a proposal this spring that will address 2014, 2015, and 2016. And we believe that by doing so, we can get back onto the statutory schedule that's laid out in the law. To me, this is the single most important thing we can do to advance the RFS. The market needs to know in advance what the regulatory requirements are going to be. This is key to making investments, the key to growth, and you know all this. So that has to be job one. That's not going to be easy, but that is what my boss, Janet McCabe, testified to in December before the committee. But we have to do more than that. We have to resolve the fundamental issues that have stymied us over the last 15 months, and you know what they are. We have to figure out how we're going to advance this cause in the face of flat and indeed declining gasoline demand going ahead into the future. We have to overcome the current market limitations, the so-called blend wall, that at least for the short term is limiting the use of ethanol in this country in the transportation sector. And of course, the biggie, whether and on what basis the statutory volume should be lowered in light of these considerations. Bob actually undershot the number of comments we got. We got 340,000 comments, and they weren't all unanimous, I can promise you that. And so over the next few months, you know, we are regrouping. We're going to be trying to answer these questions. I appreciate Bob's offer to work together with us on how we're going to answer those questions in a way that respects the purposes of the law, but also provides for practical solutions so we can make progress. So while it obviously did not come through in our 2014 proposal as clearly as we wanted it to, and I lamented this in Orlando, and I'll lament it again today, our goal was then, and it remains today, to get the RFS back on track and to provide for long-term growth of renewable fuels in this sector. That's what the law sought. That's the purpose of the law. And that certainly is our purpose at EPA in implementing it. But I do want to touch on the fact that there was other progress made last year, despite, frankly, the agency being challenged with all the controversy and the very different views we heard from very different parts of this industry on what the right thing to do is. So I want to highlight a few other areas. And I think these also further the goals of the RFS, which you're all for. So next to getting the volumes right and setting these volumes in a predictable and timely way, the most important thing EPA can do is clear the way to allow new and innovative fuels and technologies to come into the marketplace. We call this our pathways analysis, which involves life cycle modeling and is a very important part of our work. But the truth is, we were facing a very large backlog, and we simply were unable to manage the demand because the RFS has unleashed an enormous amount of creativity. And every time Dick and Harry has a new idea for a new feedstock or a new fuel and wants EPA to score it. So we made the decision, which was not very popular at the time. I'm looking at you, Jeff Cooper, who corresponded with us about this, to kind of take a break. We're going to take a pause. We're going to take 6 months and lean this process out and streamline it and come up with ways to expedite the approval process for these new pathways and these new feedstocks. And believe it or not, this is one promise I kept. We did get that work done in 6 months, and I'm pretty proud of it. I think it was the right thing to do at the time. It still is the right thing to do, and to be honest, we had no other choice. We were simply overwhelmed, and we could not sustain the path we were on. So some of the highlights. We invented a new process that we call the efficient producer process, or the efficient producer petition process. In our circles, it's called EPP, for cornstarch and grain sorghum ethanol producers that can demonstrate superior process efficiency. This new approach recognizes the innovation that is happening and continues to happen in this industry, where producers are using the latest technologies to more efficiently produce their products. We think that ought to be recognized. We don't think we should be spending an enormous amount of time on these petitions if they're similar to other things we've already approved. And so this is providing an expedited process to qualify new corn ethanol production in this country. And this is already making a difference. We said we'd be done by September 30th. We were done by September 30th. And since September 30th, we have approved 19 new efficient producer process petitions that are off and running and producing corn ethanol using the latest technology and process techniques to make their fuel even more efficient and cleaner. The average review time for these new petitions is less than 2 months. So we reduce the processing time by over 80%. And we're not satisfied. We want to reduce that even further. But just as important, because we're spending less time on these kinds of petitions, it has freed up this team to focus on the future, which is what I want them to do, and to focus on new pathways for second-generation biofuels. And since we've announced this streamlining petition, we've approved 5 new pathways for second-generation fuels and published a notice for a 6th. And these 6 are in addition to the decisions we finalized in the summer of new pathways, including the corn kernel fiber pathway and certain biogas cellulosic pathways. So when we do this work, Bob, we do take new information into account, new science into account, and it's allowed us to incorporate this latest data and scientific understanding to our models. In particular, this new efficient producer petition process essentially takes a performance-based approach because we rely on plant-specific data from producers who are doing their business in a better way. But it has not escaped our attention that there are new studies that have been published recently on both sides of this debate that have differing greenhouse gas estimates than we have stated in the past. This is another area where we're seeing a lot of divergent views. And it shows that the debate over the science, just as the debate over the policy, continues. What I promise to you is that we are going to continue to follow the science, and we're going to look for areas where we can incorporate new data into our analyses. But in this era of scarce resource, I also have to be straight with you, we're going to focus that new analysis and that new data on areas where it's going to make the most difference and on those fuels that will provide the greatest emission reductions. So without a doubt, corn ethanol has played an important role in making biofuels a significant component of our transportation fuel today. But it will be fuel from other parts of the corn plant that I think will make biofuels a much more prominent place in the transportation fuels of tomorrow. And everyone in this room knows of the huge strides that have already been made in this regard. Bob mentioned some of them. Oil from distillers grain has become widespread in just a few years. Last year, the first cellulosic fuel from corn kernel fiber was produced. Congratulations, Quad County. I know I just missed the cutoff for that award this year, but my hat's off to Quad County. There have been huge advancements in the technology for collecting and baling and storing and transporting these materials. I mean, the materials handling challenge from an engineering point of view to make this next generation of fuels were significant, and a lot of those have been overcome. I sent some of my staff on the cellulosic tour this fall, and they came back very impressed with what they saw in Iowa. We're particularly excited about this corn fiber pathway, because we think it opens up opportunities for many because it has a relatively small capital cost, no additional feedstock cost, and increased efficiency for both corn and cellulosic ethanol. So we're hopeful that this new pathway that is now approved opens the door for many, many more Quad County-type facilities. We've also seen recently significant sustained cellulosic fuel production coming from the biogas sector. Now, you probably don't care as much about that as we do, but we think it helps everybody because it provides an overall trend towards growth in cellulosic fuels and, frankly, more confidence in investment in the overall cellulosic industry. So what could possibly go wrong? All right, we got a plan. We know what we need to do. We know what the key success factors are. I have to level set with you, though, distractions to doing this work, because that's what I'm always going to do. I'm going to be straight to you. We've got a very small but dedicated team. It's getting smaller over the last 15 months that the budget has to work on these issues. My core team on renewable fuel policy issues is about 10 or 12 people. And they want to work. They love to work on the long-term strategies and getting renewable fuels policy back on track and providing for long-term growth in these fuels. And that's what we're committed to do. But we do have a few distractions that you should know about. We have multiple notices of intent to sue us from the petroleum industry on missed deadlines. This is their right. Those cases, those notices have recently ripened. And defending those lawsuits will take up my people's time and our lawyers' time. We have multiple petitions from the same industry to waive the RFS standards already on the books. We have multiple petitions from the same industry to reconsider the standards. We have a formal request to issue notice to delay the 2014 compliance requirements. Members of your industry have filed a lawsuit challenging our latest Tier 3 car and gasoline standards. Members of this industry have filed a lawsuit challenging our emissions inventory models. We have a steady stream of requests for relief, regulatory relief, from small refiners. Last I checked, there are about a dozen. We have at least three huge Freedom of Information Act requests for all documents, correspondence, emails, texts, murmurs, whispers, anything related to the renewable fuel standards implementation. We have a constant need to maintain and upgrade it and improve our IT systems, the electronic heart of RFS compliance. We have many requests for regulatory changes to keep up with this rapidly evolving business. There are indeed barriers to entry that are in our rules for certain new types of fuels that we would like to remove. And I could go on, but I'm not here to whine. This comes with the territory. As I like to tell my staff often, protecting the planet is not for sissies. And so we're going to keep grinding. That's what we do because of what is at stake. We care enormously about our mission. We care a lot about public service. That's why we do this work. And we, as you, care about the future. Let me just leave you with one thought, and then I'd like to take your questions. The RFS debate in Washington, D.C. has become overheated. It's gotten ugly at times. And my hope is that we can find a way to have a civil discourse with all sides of this debate and find a practical way forward that will work for everyone. So I very much appreciate Bob's offer to continue to work with us, despite his passionate views about the quality of our work. And I'm going to take him up on that offer, because that's one of the things I admire about Bob. We can disagree without Bob being disagreeable. There is no better advocate for this industry in Washington than Bob Dineen, and I very much value the relationship with Bob, along with his technical staff that we frequently talk to. So with that, I'd like to stop talking. Thank you for listening, and I'd be delighted to take a few questions in our remaining time.
Chris has agreed to take a few questions. If there are people that would like to ask one, go right ahead. We've got some microphones here. While perhaps someone lines up, I will say that Chris Grundler is a straight shooter. He is a dedicated public servant. He cares about what he does and what the agency does. He's committed to their mission. And while we have disagreed at times, I've always known where he stood, and I always knew that he was working hard to get to the right place. And I'm confident that working together, we can get there, Chris. We can.
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Yes, Logan Caldwell, Houston Biofuels Consultants. First, Chris, I'd like to congratulate you and your team for the efficient producer process. I've been involved with helping plants through the previous process as well as the current process, and it seemed to be working very well, even better than you had mentioned. So thank you for that. The question I had this morning is, as you all look at putting together the regulations for 3 years, for 14, 15, and 16, if the provision in the ESA 2007 law that requires that if there's been a reduction in any of the standards by 50% or more in a single year, or 20% or more in two consecutive years, that there will be a permanent reduction in that standard after consultation with the USDA and Commerce Department, public comments and whatnot. If that provision is, well, first of all, do you expect that provision to be triggered for 2016? And if so, how do you all plan to deal with it? Because my concern is that it could really drag out the process for finalizing.
You think?
Thank you.
Yeah. We refer that to the reset provision. It is a non-discretionary duty for the administrator. If certain triggers are met that you mentioned, to reset the statutory volumes. A couple limitations. You mentioned that there are different triggers, you know, 20% and 50% triggers, but this reset cannot happen before 2017. So it's not going to be a factor in what the work we are going to be doing this year for 14, 15, and 16. And in fact, these triggers have not been triggered for total or advanced. It has been, the triggers have been set. You set a trigger, you pull a trigger. The trigger's been pulled for cellulosic fuel. And so we have thought about how we would go about this reset. The statute gives us some pretty specific guidance on how to do so. It is not a trivial understanding. You think it's hard for the agency to establish volumes for 1 year, this would have us establish volumes for 5 years. So it's very, very challenging, and again, if I had been in the room with Bob and Red, I probably would have pointed out some of the difficulties of doing this reset rule, kind of one by one for each fuel standard. That's kind of a nightmare scenario, that first we would do it for cellulosic and then for whatever the next trigger and then the third trigger. So that's going to be a mess, and we're not looking forward to that because the timing is messed up. You know, the 20 factors or whatever we'd have to consider, you know, would involve a huge analysis, and then, you know, we would have to exercise judgment about what the right number would be based on all this analysis and all these factors, you know, for 2017 out to 2022. Follow up?
Okay. It won't be triggered in 16.
Okay. Correct.
Thank you.
In fact, the law, the law prevents us from doing any kind of reset prior to 2017.
Okay. As I looked at it, it looked like 2016 was the first year the law it required it. But your interpretation is 2017.
It would be the 2017 volume.
Thank you.
To be clear, while Chris was not in the room, there were EPA staff in the room.
I want their names.
Okay, not publicly, but I'll certainly give you their names. Some of them still work for you. I'll ask a question. How do you think that the RFS will ever reach its full potential if the administration does not allow the RIN mechanism to drive the marketplace? Can it succeed if the administration feels obligated to micromanage that market-based incentive?
Speaking as a citizen, I think it's very dangerous for government to interfere with markets like that. And we're not. I mean, we do not get involved in those transactions. We monitor the RIN transactions. We kind of keep the checkbook through our EMTS information technology system. We have heard over the last 15 months, gee, why don't we set a RIN price ceiling, or a RIN price safety valve, or this. We've got lots of ideas coming in from inside and outside the government, all of which we reject. We have no interest in getting involved in the RIN market. We think markets work best. I mean, so this is a personal opinion. I think markets work best without EPA mucking around in them. And it's obvious even though I wasn't in the room, that what Congress intended was that this system would, in fact, create the right kind of incentives, and the market would evolve so that it could absorb these volumes. Clearly, that hasn't happened. No one was surprised at EPA when RIN prices started going up as the blend wall approached, and in fact, some of our economists wrote papers predicting it. It happened, I think, a little bit sooner than everyone predicted. Notice I'm filibustering and not answering your question. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist to interpret what Congress had in mind with respect to how this marketplace should work, and that RIN prices would go up, you know, as things start to get tougher. And RIN prices are trading, well, where's Rachel Gant? She's my source for RIN prices. What are they trading at today? D6.50, 60 cents? Yeah. So we've actually done quite a bit of work with respect to asking ourselves the question, the relationship between RIN prices and consumer prices for both gasoline and diesel. I hope someday that work will be published. And we can confront some of those questions. But we want the RIN market to work as it was intended. I'll leave it at that.
We'll take one more because we got to get to the panel. But
yeah, Pat Foody at Iogen. I applaud your effort to do three-year forward RVOs, particularly for the cellulosic area. But there's clearly a lot of uncertainty in the volumes that that could arise from production. Can you say something about the process you'll use for the RVO setting for cellulosics, and if you see a possibility for a revision of volumes annually if the market outperforms your expectations?
Well, that's a very good question and a bit of a sore spot, and so I'm going to try to behave, because we have been wrong on our cellulosic projections every single year, perhaps relying too much on the irrational exuberance of people in that business. So I'm not very happy about our record, and I'm not very happy about the information that we received that was so far off. We also have some very particular guidance from the courts about how to do that estimate and to take a neutral aim. You're asking a very nuanced question, and should we be setting it and then revising it based on what the market actually does? And of course, that's a two-edged sword and could go in both directions. I'm not convinced, and we have talked about it quite a bit, that would be kind of a good thing in terms of market signals and showing and allowing for the industry to grow if the agency adopts a policy that, you know, if it underperforms, you know, we are going to ratchet it back. That could produce some perverse results. What I believe now, because you know, now we're seeing real volumes, largely because of the biogas sector, but we're eagerly awaiting volumes from POET and Abengoa and soon DuPont, that kind of the precision that is going to be required or that had been required in the past won't be so important, because we'll have so much volume that if we undershoot or overshoot, it's not gonna have a big impact. But we'll see.
I know there are more questions, and I apologize, but the next panel is a very important one, and there are many speakers, so we really do need to get to that. I'm sure Chris will be around for a few minutes if he can answer questions. But let's give citizen Chris Grundler a big round of applause. Thank you.